I'd like to acknowledge Australia's First Nation people as the traditional custodians of the land, and for this episode in particular, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging.
Wine brings people to the industry, and then when you're there, I think it's the people in the industry that make you stay. You should go, oh, wow, I found like-minded people, and it's a lot of fun.
This is Over a Glass. I'm Shantae Whale. Anthony Fickers is making his own way in wine in the sub-region of Nullumbik. This is a shire located outside of Melbourne in the northeast. Championing minimal intervention wine, he is a new generation of winemaker turning heads with his label Rising Wines. Hi, Anthony. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Shantae.
Such a pleasure. You know, I've come across your wines a few times, and I will be as proud to say that I've definitely had them as our kind of drinking wine throughout the week and enjoyed them thoroughly. So I'm really glad to be able to chat to you today. How is vintage going, and where are you at in the process?
So vintage is finished up down here, Shantae. We picked our last grapes, I think, at the end of March in the Yarra. That didn't include another little project that I've got down in Mornington. But for both Yarra and Mornington wines, they're finished fermenting. The reds are mainly through malolactic fermentation. I think I've got maybe four or five batches out of 20 or 30 in the winery that are doing something or other. In some cases, malo. In some cases, chugging through the last gram of sugar. And who really knows? You can, you know, stick your ear over them. They're doing something, so they will remain unsulfured for the time being.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, they are alive entities, aren't they? And sometimes you've just got to leave them alone and see what happens.
That's exactly right. I don't like asking the lab to, you know, check everything, you know, every week or every, you know, twice a week or whatever. I'd rather just go and look at the barrel and pull the bung out and see if there's pressure and put my ear over it and look at how cloudy the wine is and whether it looks like a sort of a yeast cloudiness or a bacterial cloudiness. Yeah, if it looks like it's doing something, then let it be, as long as it's not going too feral.
Perfect. Now, tell me a little bit about, you have had an amazing history with working some amazing places and great winemakers, but let's go right back and just tell us about how you got involved in wine and what's your first memory of either seeing someone else drink wine or what's your first memory of wine?
So I grew up in Wollongong in New South Wales, so not a known wine region by any means. And my parents drank wine around the table, so it was always kind of there. And I guess I first started drinking wine when I'd go to parties, and you know, most of the time as a young guy, you'd take, you know, a six pack of beer or something like that, and you'd have to put it in the ice bucket, and then, you know, your beers would go missing overnight, and I'd think, you know, there's got to be a better way than this. And so I cottoned on to the fact that, you know, red wine you didn't have to put in the esky, you could just kind of hide it behind a pillar somewhere or whatever. And I sort of got into red wine. I thought, this stuff's pretty good. And I remember just going down to the local, you know, bottle shop, quite a generic sort of big company bottle shop, and they'd have little stickers underneath each wine, and, you know, one would have a pizza on it, another one would have lamb on it, and I was like, what's all this about, you know? Like, they're saying that I should be drinking this with pizza and this one with lamb. Surely red wine is red wine. And so, you know, they'd do 20% off if you bought a six pack. So I remember one day I thought I'll buy a six pack and I'll just try through these red wines and just see if there's any difference. And I was absolutely blown away that there was any difference at all. I honestly thought it was just a scam by, you know, the supermarket and wine companies to basically have the same, you know, red wine was red wine and you put different fancy labels on it and charge more or less according to the label. So it was a real revelation to me that this was the case, and I was just hooked from that point. And as you know, Shantae, it's just such a rabbit hole, the whole world of wine. You know, you end up spending a bit more and trying different regions, and, you know, and this is all just in the context of Australia. And then down the track, you start trying French wines and Italian wines, and it was mind-boggling. Yeah, so at the same time, I was doing a science degree at Wollongong University and kind of thinking, this isn't really for me. I knew I liked sciencey-based things, but I really wanted a job where I could sit down at the end of the day and say, you know, I did that or I made that, not, you know, spend 10 years researching some, you know, protein that may or may not cure cancer, probably not. So I really wanted a science-based field where I could make something. And, you know, at the same time, I'm getting into wine, learning about wine and wine styles. And lo and behold, I'm flicking through the book that has all the uni degrees, because back in those days, I thought that was the only way that you get anywhere in life. You have to go to uni. And there it was, you know, Bachelor of Wine Science at CSU. And I thought, is this serious? Like, you can actually go to uni and learn how to make wine. And I thought, how good's this? The stars have aligned. And so off I went to CSU.
Awesome. And you're a Wollongong boy. I can't believe that. I went to high school at Wollongong Performing Arts. I know that's off topic, but I just love that. That's amazing.
Yeah. I was aware that you're based up in the northern suburbs there. So I grew up around Balgowney sort of way.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, it's a awesome. Nice part of the world. Get back there a fair bit to visit family.
Yeah, it really is. I think we've got so much at our fingertips here. But back onto why we're here. but I love that. You know, it makes me feel like, you know, people from the Gong can do great bloody things. You know, they talk crap about us, but
I do like seeing Wollongong come up in like the Instagram Batuta things. You know, there's always the odd, probably every 6 months, there's sort of a little Batuta post on Wollongong, and it's always pretty funny.
They crack me up. They're very clever.
Yeah.
So you ended up finishing your degree, and then did you end up going straight to the Hunter Valley? Was that the next step?
Oh, I got quite a few credits. So I actually only did like 1 year. I did 1 year on campus back in the old days when CSU actually wanted you on campus. And so then I went out. I only had after that 1 year to go. So I went and started working. And, went up to the Hunter. I had my first proper vintage. I say proper because I helped crush maybe 20 or 30 tons of Chardonnay in 2000 out in Ludnam, out towards Penrith in Western Sydney. There's a little winery out there, and we crushed some Chardonnay out there. And I did my first proper vintage at Mount Pleasant in the Hunter in 2002. And I absolutely loved it. Like I can still remember to this day just how much fun it was, you know, just working hard, playing hard. The setup was that everyone started at the same time and finished at the same time. So we could all have knockoff beers and often we'd kick on to someone's house for a barbecue or something like that. And I just thought, this is the most fun thing in the world. And luckily from there, the guy that was the winemaker, well, under Phil Ryan at the time, so I guess the operational sort of winemaker, Scott Stevens, he moved over to Bortley's when they opened up a winery in the Hunter in 2003. And he said, oh, why don't you come and work as my assistant? So I took on that. And then that kind of segued me down to, doing vintage with the Bortley's in the Yarra Valley. And, once I got down here, I was like, wow, how good is this? You know, so many wine styles made so well, you know, in the Hunter, like I love the Hunter, but it was, you know, it was very much at the time it was Chardonnay, Shiraz and Semillon. And, you know, Semillon's world class. And, you know, I love personally the Chardonnays and the Shirazes from up there. But maybe they're not as recognised as much sort of outside the people who know in a way, I guess. Mm. And then I came down here and it was just like, wow, every variety you could think of and, you know, being made really well and being held out as an example as world-class Australian wine, you know, Pinot, Chardonnay, Cabernet blends, maybe not so much Shiraz, but, you know, around here, again, a bit like the Hunter Shiraz, it's a bit more, you know, people who know it and love it, don't stop talking about it. So I just really love the diversity down here. And the fact that, I guess at the time, everyone was talking about Pinot and Pinot's rise and how it was, you know, the greatest red wine in the world and Burgundy this and Burgundy that. And I really wanted to learn how to make Pinot. That's kind of how I made my way down to the Yarra Valley.
Interesting, I think. And then I think I can understand why somewhere like the Yarra can look more, like, attractive to especially someone kind of up and coming as well. That in the Hunter, you know, you've got some pretty well-established houses there, and so too you do in the Yarra as well. But you've got, I think, a bit more of a breadth of smaller operations and things like that. So I can see, you know, the attraction of kind of paving your way down there as well. You certainly went to some of the best with your experience in terms of working for Giant Steps and Medhurst and good old Mac Forbes. What was your experience like with all those different winemakers and wineries?
Oh, it's amazing when I sort of sit and think about all the, like, really, really amazing winemakers I've worked with. I just go, wow, how lucky am I that I kind of, you know, came across these people. Even just at, like, When I came down to the Bortleys in the Yarra just to do vintages from the Hunter, the crew at the Bortleys in, I think it was 2004, it was just phenomenal. They had Steve Weber was there, David Slingsby Smith, Paul Bridgman, Ben Kane, who's over in the States now, Sarah, who's the winemaker there now, she was sort of maybe an assistant or head cellar hand or something like that. Bill Downey was there. It was just phenomenal. I look back and I'm like, how did you actually afford to have so many winemakers? And I don't really have an answer to the question in my own head. But it was just I think Steve Weber just loved the fact that, you know, there was all these creative, amazing winemakers there all working together, and they were really having a crack at, you know, his goal at the time was, we want to make the best Pinot in Australia in the next few years. And they were having such a big crack at it. So that was a really amazing place. And then to move on and, you know, work with Mac for 5.5 years, you know, a few years down the track, that was awesome. That was really at the start of his journey. Like, his model has changed a lot since then. When I worked for him, we were mainly just buying fruit. We spent a lot of time with the growers, but we were mainly just buying fruit. And it really was after I left there in 2012, he started, like, leasing more and more vineyards and planting vineyards. And, his model's changed a lot, but it was really amazing to work with him for 5.5 years and see the birth of, you know, what's become, you know, his brand, and he's become, you know, one of the most well recognized winemakers, not just in the Yarra, but I think even worldwide. You know, you go over to Europe and people know Mac because you know, he's that kind of character. You meet him, you're not going to forget him. He's done so much to promote the Yarra and help people understand about the Yarra. You know, the whole start of the upper and the lower Yarra conversation with the trade, I think it was probably talked about internally, you know, amongst winemakers, but I'm not sure that the wine trade really understood the differences across the Yarra Valley until Mac started talking about it and put a map together, and it's like, you know, this is why this is cooler up here, and this is, you know, why it's a bit warmer down in Coldstream. So that was really amazing to see from a winemaking point of view, but also, I guess, a marketing and communication to trade sort of point of view. And that's where I started. I started my own label working for Mac as well, so he was very encouraging of that. So that was So my original label was Ficker's Two Bricks, which was it's a nickname given to me by the guys at the Bortleys. I don't know if it was Paul Bridgman or Bill Downey, probably a combo of the two. They used to like to give everyone a nickname, and it was Ficker's Two Bricks or Tony. And yeah, so I kind of used that as my label, and it's I was always got a bit of a chuckle. You know, I never set out to make really serious wines with my label. I just wanted to have fun, accessible wines, so it worked well. And then later, I developed the very originally thought out label Ficker's Single Vineyard when I needed to charge more money for Chardonnay and Pinot.
I actually think that that's a great element, because I think accessible wines is really, really important for our market. And you know, like you said, it's not always just about making, you know, really exclusive wines that you have to pay through the nose for. It's about everybody enjoying wine. And I think that, you know, the consideration towards what's accessible is a really important one that perhaps maybe some people don't always strive for. So, and having fun while you're doing it. I mean, isn't that the whole point? Like you said, you went from a degree where you couldn't believe that, you know, that people were doing this and it was fun, and you got to kind of keep a little bit of that along the way, I think.
Oh, for sure. I think that probably, you know, 95% of the wine industry realize that and do have fun, and that's why you stay, you know. Like, I think it attracts like-minded people, and you know, industry events and work can just be a lot of fun. You know, vintage can be a lot of fun. It's a lot of hard work, but when you get like-minded people in a winery together, who are all willing to hang around and do long days day after day and have a laugh, it's a lot of fun.
Definitely. I mean, you know, you're talking to a hospo person, that we get involved in it because I think the idea is of sitting in an office doesn't sound thrilling to us, and working with our hands and working in a team in a high-paced environment, it is just so attractive, and the adrenaline, it just gets under your skin. And I imagine vintage is exactly the same as that. And like you said, at the end of the day, it's exhausting, but you put your feet up and you look around you and think, I went to war with these people, and that beer just tastes so much better at the end of the day, doesn't it?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I remember when I was at Medhurst with Simon Steele, we used the analogy, we stole it off a chef. It might have been like Anthony Bourdain or something, who said that, you know, being in a kitchen's is like being on a pirate ship. And it kind of can feel a bit like that, you know, it can get a bit loose. But you're all there with one common goal, and you're all putting in, and at the end of the day, yeah, like you say, Shantae, that beer does taste extra good.
Yeah, when you've earned it, only until then.
Yeah.
So you also did some traveling, and I can see that you've ticked off some of the big names of going over to Piedmont in Italy and France in Burgundy and then Baden of all places, hopefully working with some Pinot. What was the kind of country or region that really impacted your kind of philosophy, or that you took something from and thought, I want to keep that ideal when I come back and create my own label?
Yeah, I think definitely the visit to Piedmont and Burgundy, they're the top two. The German travel was more to follow my partner. She was studying for a year in Germany, and she was way down in the south, on the Swiss border. And so I just needed somewhere convenient, to be honest. The winery wasn't great. The wines we made were definitely not great. I learned a lot about mold and how much mold you can have in grapes and still make wine that kind of tastes okay. But the people there were lovely, you know, and yeah, like I sort of touched on before, I think it's wine brings people to the industry. And then when you're there, I think it's the people in the industry that make you stay. You should go, oh, wow, I found like-minded people, and it's a lot of fun. So, yeah, the German winery I worked with was not the greatest, but they were a lot of fun and they were lovely people. So it was a great experience. But to go to Piedmont and work with Pederi Colla, and then go to Burgundy, and it was a very short trip to Burgundy. I was only there for about 10 days, but I worked with Cécile Tremblay.
Holy moly, no you didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
Stop it.
And Mac, I was working for Mac at the time, and he hooked that up for me. He said, oh, I love her wines, and we'll just find a way that you can go and work with her. And he did.
I am so fangirling right now. I think they are some of the most stunning ethereal wines on the planet. I am just so amazed. Good for you. 10 days. 10 days in heaven. Oh.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it was amazing. I think I was there for every pick. I think the first ferment I'd only just started, but that was kind of inconsequential. It didn't matter. I saw every pick, went into every vineyard. We spent one day. I got there the first day. She picked me up, and I jumped into a wooden vat, and I was like scrubbing a vat with sulfur and lighting it up, to kill off any bacteria or whatever had grown in there. And then the next day we started picking, and I think on about the fourth day we stopped, and we went around to every vineyard that we hadn't picked, and just tasted fruit in all these amazing vineyards. And I think we finished the day drinking champagne and stuff. And I was like, wow, that was like the best, wine day of my life. It was just so educational to taste the fruit in the vineyards and walk through with her. It was amazing.
Wow. I mean, did you pick her brains about what she was after? Or, I mean, I would just have so many questions. She probably would have gotten rid of me and been like, my God, she's this one. what did you learn from her? I mean, what did you take away other than that she's got good taste in champagne and knows what she's doing?
I think she was definitely picking a bit earlier than others. I really like the point of where she picks, where she's not necessarily waiting for full on flavor. She's still picking with a lot of vibrancy. I don't know. It's kind of hard to explain, but when you walk through and you talk to her and you sort of pick berries that are a bit riper and you go, what do you think? Is that in the right zone? And she'd say, yeah, I reckon that's spot on. We just need, two more days to get the rest of it to that point. And breaking up blocks and saying, like, we'll pick this top half separately to this half because there's a different energy here. All that stuff you take on board. There's no great secret. That was the first time I'd ever seen anyone cut the middle of the stem out in the cellar. That takes a long time. I learned that. Yeah, so that's from a winemaking sort of technique point of view, that was the first time I'd seen that. And it's like, that makes a lot of sense, but you've got to be making really expensive wine to afford to do it. But to get rid of the middle of the stalk, so you're getting rid of a huge proportion of potential green stalky tannin, I should say. And then, yeah, still getting full carbonic fermentation. It's like, oh, wow, that's an awesome idea. But until you can charge, hundreds of dollars for your wine.
Yeah, you haven't got the labor to do that, do you?
Yeah, it's just one to file away.
Amazing. I want to talk about your brand Rising. I know that you're a busy man and you make wine for In Dreams and also the Styx brand, but the Rising brand is the wine, or the brand that I've come across a few times, and the wines have just really stopped me in my tracks, in particular the Cabernet and the Gamay that you make. What's your aim with Rising Wines, and how come you identify with Nelumbic and, talk about that sub-region rather than kind of, I know you put Yarra Valley on the label, but what's the aim of Rising Wines?
So I guess to go back to the start, Rising Wines is based, not exclusively, but the majority of the wines we make come from the Rising Vineyard in St. Andrews, which is in the Shire of Nelumbic. It's not the Shire of the Yarra Ranges. So Shire of the Yarra Ranges encapsulates Coldstream, Hillsville, Yarra Junction, Gladysdale, all the probably 95% of the Yarra Valley brands, maybe more. And over in Nelumbic, we are in the Yarra Valley GI wine region, but we're not in the Yarra Ranges. So it's a small distinction, but it's quite significant. The soils and the altitude and sunlight hours are all a bit different over in Nelumbic. So we've started trying to talk about the Rising brand in terms of Nelumbic, just so we've got that distinction, because if you line up particularly, I think, the Pinots, if you line up, say, a Nilembic Pinot, a Coldstream Pinot and a Gladysdale Pinot, I think the Coldstream and the Gladysdale, you could probably go, you know, Gladysdale, that looks like Upper Yarra, Coldstream, Lower Yarra. This other one just kind of looks a bit, I don't know, not quite right almost. The soils up there are much more degraded than the rest of the Yarra Valley. Really skinny topsoils, very undulating land, and more sunshine hours in general. So quite warm days, and then really cool nights as well. So the top of Rising Vineyard, for instance, is 250 metres above sea level. So it's the diurnal fluctuations quite high. So really cold mornings and nights and warm days. And so you get quite different wines. So we're just trying to, I guess, get out there and say, hey, our wines do look different. Some people will like them, some people won't. That's cool. But this is why they're different. And again, I guess going back to when Mac was trying to educate people about Upper and Lower Yarra Valley, we're just trying to sort of add the third bit onto that, the third part of the valley, which we see as Nilembic. In terms of the Gamay and the Cabernet Franc, they both actually come from another vineyard, not from Rising. And we brought those on board. At the inception of the brand because they do, I guess, have that kind of left field sort of wow factor. I know they're becoming more and more common, but there's still not heaps of them around. And at the end of the day, we were going to start Rising the label mainly with Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. And there's just so many good Yarra Valley Pinots and Chardonnays, it's a bit hard to sort of distinguish yourself. So we thought if we bring on board a Cabernet Franc and a Gamay, and particularly if we make them in a kind of, I guess, a sort of interesting way with lots of whole bunches, then hopefully people will go, oh, they look cool. Oh, and, you know, out of the swathes of Yarra Valley Chardonnay that there is out there, yours is actually really, really good as well and quite unique. So that's why we have those two wines on board.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I really like the idea of kind of hailing and championing where you're from and what makes you guys unique, other than what you maybe do in the winery as well. And with the Nilembic Bad Earth, you know, series and labels, you know, it's great to be talking about where you are and why, you know, why your wines do taste like they do in the bottle, you know. And I think I haven't looked at the Bad Earth series. So you've got your aromatic dry white and your light dry red and nice little rosé and a pet nat. And so I'm super curious. I mean, they draw you in already and think, oh, what am I in for that? Especially I particularly like when people name their wines after, like you said, a style of wine rather than just what the varietal or the makeup is, because I think you look at the wine in a holistic sense of what is this telling me it's going to offer me rather than let me dissect it.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you've hit the nail on the head there. Like, they are not wines that really need to be dissected. They're just pleasurable bistro style wines that, you know, they do have pretty cool labels on them, I reckon. And they kind of grab your attention and they've got flavor and they just kind of taste good. You know, I think at the end of the day, the aim with wine is to make it taste good. And we're not trying to make anything too serious with the Bad Earth range. Hence, you know, we've got rosé, we've got pet nat, and we've got a white and a red. It's just quite simple. And yeah, they're just meant to be good fun wines. Whereas with the core range of Rising from the Rising Vineyard, that's the Pinot and the Chardonnay, they're meant to be more serious wines in a way, still very pleasurable to drink, but a lot more, I guess, expressive of that particular site and the terroir, for lack of a better word, that you see in Nilembic.
Yeah, perfect. It's so nice. I think maybe, you know, you have taken something from out of Mac's book, because I feel like the messaging is clear and you know, you are fairly small operation in terms of how much you produce. And I feel like your wines are really, you know, put into a category where you can kind of see by the labels, by the price point, by, you know, the way that you're talking about them, where they all sit, which is really clear. And that's actually really important when people are trying to almost digest a new winery and a new estate, like, what's this all about and how do I process it? I think that that is really important. But talk about, you are pretty minimal intervention. I sulfur imagine when you need to. How do you approach in terms of talking about minimal intervention and kind of that natural scope of the wine world?
Yeah, I think the main thing for me with minimal intervention, probably the biggest issue that I see is you just don't use too much oak. Most of my wines, like all the rising stuff, ends up in oak. A lot of the time, because, you know, even with the bad earth stuff, there's such a small volume that I don't have tanks that small, and you never, you know, fit them into tanks. So they go into oak, but they'll go into old oak. And for me, that's one of the biggest things. People still hear people talk about, you know, minimal intervention, and then you kind of taste their wines and there's a fair whack of oak in there. It might not be completely smothered, but that's for me the biggest issue there. Other than that, you know, I just think it's more hand picking, gentle destemming or pressing, minimal use of sulfur, and not really adding anything else. You know, letting wild yeast do their thing. And then at the end of the process, filtering as little as possible. So, you know, I think filters, you know, can probably make you sleep a bit better at night, not worrying about what's going in your wines, but they definitely take something out, you know. Sometimes, you know, I've seen vintages where the filter actually make things look better, like 2016 in the Yarra Valley was really hot, and there were some weird sort of colours and hazes and stuff in a lot of Pinots. And then I saw some filtered versions and I thought, they actually look a bit tidier and cleaner, but did they look less like 2016 at the same time? They kind of probably did. And, you know, most people might say, that's a good thing. But, but it's not necessarily the most honest way to make wine.
Yeah. I think it's really important these days to be able to talk about where you sit in your philosophies, because there is a grey area when it comes to some of the words we throw around these days about, you know, what style of wine we are. So I think it's important to define it in what way you can as well. So what's next for you on the cards? I feel like you've got a few projects happening. Are we just going to take it easy and put your feet up for the rest of the year, or you've got more happening elsewhere?
Oh, no, there's always something happening. So yeah, we're planting, we've bought a property on the other side of the valley in the Upper Yarra to complement Rising. So we'll kind of have, I guess, the yin and the yang of Yarra Valley sites. And so we plan to plant at the end of this year. And so, yeah, I'm kind of getting my head around that and organising people to do stuff that I don't quite understand. And being a winemaker and not so much a vineyard planter, it's been a steep learning curve, but a really fun one. And it's going to be, or it has been so far, and I'm sure will be, you know, in 3 or 4 years when I finally pick something off that vineyard, it's going to be, you know, a really rewarding process to go from you know, basically a cow paddock to, you know, a really cool vineyard, I think. So that's my major project. And the other thing we have on the boil is in 2000, yeah, 2000, we signed a lease on a vineyard in Mornington on Main Ridge. So I made the first wines. I've made the first wines from that site, just Pinot and Chardonnay, in 2001, and actually bottled those last week. And there's no label or anything yet. That's still to be determined. It's kind of a work in progress, but I'm really happy with the wines. I'd never made Mornington Peninsula wines before. So that's been a lot of a great learning curve as well. Just looking at the differences, between Yarra and and Mornington, and I think we've got a really, really good site down there. It's been a lot of fun making those wines.
Oh, totally different makeup. And I think it's interesting because you really want to be, like you said, a minimal intervention winemaker, not doing what, when you need to not do something, you do it, but you're actually working with two of the hardest varietals where they don't just make themselves, unlike a few other varieties we have in here in Australia. So, but Mornington's, what a great region as well. So I look forward to hearing more about those. Anthony, I do ask everyone on the podcast just to find out a little bit more about who they are and what makes them tick. If you could only drink three boozy beverages for the rest of your life, what would they be and why?
I would probably start. So if I say I'm on my deathbed and I have to have three drinks in a row, maybe you should rephrase that to that one.
Perfect.
I'd probably start with a beer. I don't drink super fancy beers or anything. At the moment, I've been at the winery in particular, have a beer in the afternoon. We've been drinking Hargraves Hill hazy pale ale or something like that out of a can. And I just like something with a little bit of flavour, not heaps of flavour, not all that weird sort of sour beer and that. Sorry, people who like that stuff. But I just kind of like, one step up from what the old timers would call normal beer, I guess.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't know if that sort of explained it. And then definitely Chardonnay. Like if I could only have one boozy drink for the rest of my life, it would be Chardonnay. I just love it. I love making it. I love drinking it. I think there's so many different styles out there that if I only had one choice, you could drink Chardy and you'd cover a lot of bases, from Blanc de Blanc through to, full-blown, big sort of styles of Burgundy. It's going to be pretty obvious, I think. If I've got to choose a third boozy beverage, it's probably going to be Pinot, closely followed by Beaujolais. Mm. I've got to say, in terms of French wines, French reds, that's definitely the one that I drink the most, mainly because I can afford it, as opposed to red Burgundy proper, Pinot Noir Burgundy. I really do love a good Beaujolais.
Absolutely. They're so good. They're such good drinks. And you're right, like for the hip pocket, it doesn't hurt as much, but there's some pretty serious, Beaujolais out there that's just made exceptionally well, and they are such delicious drinks. So
yeah, and the density they can get is quite amazing, particularly after I've made a few now in the Yarra, and they're like the Gamays I've made are quite light. Even when I try and push ripeness a bit more, they just look light, and then I look at the Beaujolais, proper Beaujolais, and go, wow, how do they get that density? it's pretty cool.
Yeah, density and concentration and tannin and
yeah.
You're very true. Well, Anthony, it's been such a pleasure chatting to you. I have to say thanks to the beer thief that stole your beers out of the bathtub all those years ago, because it means that you're working in wine and we're thrilled about that. But it's been really lovely to getting to know you. And I love the Rising Wines and for that matter, the Dreams and Sticks brands as well. So keep on keeping on. And thanks for spending a bit of time with me today. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been fun. Thanks, Shantae.
Hopefully we'll meet in person one day and we can continue on our chat.
Yeah, sounds good.
Sounds good. Cheers to you, mate.
All right, bye.
This is Over a Glass. I'm Shantae Whale. Stay tuned for more stories from the world of wine and drinks. Listen in every Thursday on your podcast app. Follow us on Instagram at overaglasspod and contact us at overaglass@deepintheweeds.com.au.